Welcome today to an interview series with Outstanding Professionals. I'm Steve Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with Lynn Langit, highly regarded and renowned developer, visionary executive, best-selling author, top international solutions architect, Microsoft Redmond. Lynn, you have a diverse background with a lifetime of significant contributions. Thank you for sharing your deep experiences and insights with our audience.
Well, hello, Stephen, and thank you for inviting me to participate in your program.
So, Lynn, you know, you got this great background, so, you know, very diverse. So what really triggered your initial interest in technology?
From an educational background, I studied languages and linguistics. And as I advanced my professional career, I was first a business person and had some businesses that were in the computer area. And as I worked in this area, I found that I had more and more interest in the inner workings of both hardware and software, and that's really how I made the career switch from the business side to the technical side.
So you've had a variety of roles in your career, and really it's quite a remarkable career. So what two lessons can you share from each of your prior roles?
Well, from the business side, I think what I gained that has been most significant and useful throughout my career is a sense of practicality. In other words, designing and implementing what will actually work, what is doable. And that serves me particularly well in the technology side because, frankly, I sometimes find that to be not as much of a priority or sometimes even absent in people that purely come from the technology side. Now, that being said, as a technologist, I'm going to sound like I'm contradicting myself here, I think it's important to think beyond what is already there, think beyond the current paradigms. For example, I'm right now working around Windows 7 evangelism, particularly around multi-touch and understanding and explaining multi-touch application development for developers and other implementers. And because it's a new paradigm, I'm encouraging people to think beyond just replacing mouse clicks with touches because it's a different way to interact. So the combination of practicality and imagination.
Well, throughout your career, you must have encountered, you know, challenges or obstacles. So what were the biggest obstacles in your career and how did you overcome them?
Well, you know, I've had a very atypical career. First, I come from a rural area in the center of the United States, and I was the first person in my family to have any sort of advanced schooling. My father actually only went up through the sixth grade, and my mom did graduate from high school, but there wasn't a very big emphasis on advanced education. So that was sort of the first challenge, and I have always been a reader and a curious person, and I knew from early childhood that I wanted to go on and get a university degree. Given that there wasn't a lot of precedence in my family, it was a little bit non-traditional, the route that I took, because there wasn't really any sort of guidance. So I was the first person in my family to go to the university, and at that time I was very interested in languages because some of my relatives were actually from Europe and spoke another language besides English. They spoke German. So I studied that first. Well, that didn't lead to an obvious career, so that was probably my second challenge, because when you're from West Fargo, North Dakota, and you have a degree in German, there isn't a straight line to a career. So I got out in the work world for a while and did various things and was quite successful because I just sort of have a propensity to being successful at work, but was successful in a career that wasn't the right career for me. So after having been in that career for a while in the business world, I found that whenever there was technology involved in the business world, which became more and more, I was quite interested in that. So I made a very dramatic career switch in the middle of my life from being a business executive to really starting at the bottom. I became a technical trainer and worked my way through technical training, then you know, got my own company in terms of technology, and now I work with Microsoft as an evangelist.
How would you describe your top innovative achievements in terms of the problems you were trying to solve, your solutions, and the impact it has today and into the future?
Well, one of the things I've been really excited about in joining Microsoft, because frankly I wasn't super interested in joining Microsoft when I was approached by human resources people to join the company, is what I call intrapreneuring. Because I had a very successful consulting business implementing software solutions and designing and conducting customized technology training, I really wasn't very interested in leaving my business and joining a large corporation. I was very hesitant, and I was very successful. So I was in a good position, and I negotiated very heavily, not so much around compensation, because frankly that was okay, but around the other factors. And the other factors to me were to be able to contribute through the power of the corporation to areas of society that I thought I could make an impact. And to that end, I negotiated, and I do now spend 25% of my time on this problem of women in technology, which has been very satisfying. And I do that by working with Microsoft on a global program called DigiGirls, which is a series of annual events that are hosted to showcase possible careers in technology for high school-aged girls. And I participate in other women in technology programs and have actually designed some programs that have been implemented globally. So that's a particular area of interest. Another area of interest is furthering the state of languages and tools. Because I come from a linguistics rather than computer science background, as I've sort of studied backwards to fill in the gap, since I don't have a formal computer science degree, I have found that there are a lot of concepts and methodologies in linguistics that don't appear to me to be available in computer languages and tools. And in fact, one of the things I negotiated when I joined Microsoft was the possibility that I might go back and do some doctoral research around this topic, and I may do so. One of the things I did do also when I joined is I had a competency in SQL Server Business Intelligence, and I had wanted to complete a second book, which I've been able to do. So the flexibility that I've had around this role has been really a great thing, and it's made a lot possible at Microsoft for me.
You know, you talked about DigiGirls. Didn't you just come off a conference or something like that?
Well, actually, a couple things. This week, I'll be hosting the fourth instance in Southern California up in Los Angeles, which is kind of unusual because most geographies only host one instance per year, and I'm trying to make a statement about the need to have more events. And I'm also trying to build a group of girls that have gone through the live program, because one of the aspects of my vision for DigiGirls is to create a virtual version and to bring girls who have attended live events into the virtual DigiGirls events, which will help us to really scale and have an impact globally as proctors and eventual instructors, because all of us technologists know that when you teach a topic, you have a new level of understanding, and also that will help girls to get into leadership roles. So my ultimate goal with the scaling of DigiGirls is to provide more pipeline of technical women that companies like Microsoft and other technical companies can hire, because frankly, especially on the developer side, we don't even have pipeline. One of the other things that's been really exciting is I've gotten into quite a bit of international speaking at my own request, because I think another important aspect of women in technology is to see women who are out on stages at conferences, and particularly in keynotes. And this year I've had the opportunity with Microsoft to speak in Belgium and in Sweden at Tech Days, and then I've recently returned from Tech Ed Africa in Durban, where I was actually part of my first keynote, so it was pretty exciting.
So what are some of the lessons from your keynote?
Well, it was an interesting keynote because it was a bit atypical. Rather than one or two speakers carrying the keynote for a long period of time, we tried a different approach, which is something that I like to do anyway. We had an introduction in Durban, and then we had 13 presenters who presented for 10 to 15 minutes demonstrating different aspects of our technologies. And, of course, as I mentioned, I've been recently working quite a bit with Windows 7. So I got to present to the both IT pro and developer crowd on some of the great features of Windows 7. So lessons learned is you have to be very concise and compelling. You have 2,500, 2,700 people, and you need to keep their attention.
Did you tell any jokes throughout your presentation?
I did. I always have to add a joke or two. Of course, being in Africa was a little bit atypical. So one of the things that I was doing is I was showing some of the different features of Win7 Taskbar and some of the different UX features. So I wanted to play some music, too, because I think that makes it a little bit more fun. So the music I chose was American Woman, because, I was an American woman in Africa. And I think everyone got the joke. There was pretty general laughter there when I turned it on.
Excellent. So how does your background as a linguist factor in your current work?
Oh, it is so important. I am really a translator, and that it's ironic because when I was a little girl growing up in North Dakota, that was my dream. My dream was specifically to be a UN translator, so I certainly had big dreams. However, I'm just a different kind of translator because I'm translating two different audiences, so I must tailor my presentations so those audiences can understand. And then I'm translating technologies, so it's a double layer of translation. It's actually better than I would have assumed. And I'll give you a very specific example. One of the things that I have learned is that U.S. audiences and other countries' audiences, I'll give a specific example of European, have different expectations in terms of sessions at a professional conference. U.S. audiences, in particularly where I work in Southern California, in the coasts, I think this is more, tend to expect what we call edutainment. So more jokes, still some technical content, but jokes and interaction. Things like Twitter are a big part of U.S. conferences. People will tweet as you're going, and I've even had people use live streaming, be it quick, and live stream my conference presentations. This has not been the case for me in Belgium and in Sweden. It's a more sort of traditional audience where the audience expects you to be the authority, and they're not expecting to have interactivity. Questions are held to the end. So the result is I'm presenting 15 to 20 minutes more material when I'm presenting in Europe. And that's a really dramatic difference. And as I've talked to speakers that present all over the world, I'm not the only one who's noticed this. Speakers that are very effective truly think about their audiences and deliver different presentation styles based on those audiences.
I see. So I'm really sort of intrigued. And a lot of our audience would like to, or are involved in presentations. What would be your top tips for doing presentations?
Well, there's no substitute for knowing the technology. That just goes without saying, but you have to say that because if you don't, you're delivering a technical presentation and you don't have depth of knowledge in technology, you shouldn't be doing that. The best way, in my opinion, to get the depth of technology is to actually work with the technology. One of the things, again, that I've been very fortunate in entrepreneuring at Microsoft is I have participated for many years with nonprofits, and it's very important to me. Some of those are in Africa, some of those in the United States, and that's the way that I get my implementation practice so I can actually keep my hand in the real world, because it's one thing to read what the product teams talk about the products or read a book. It's quite a different thing to actually implement the product. So you must know the technology first, and the best way to know that is through implementation. Second, you must know your audience. And one of the things that I've been doing as I've been traveling, for example, I just went to Africa, is I'll contact people who have spoken in Africa, preferably Americans if I can find them, or people with my background, and say, what was your experience? What was different? So take the time to find out from people who have spoken in the particular situation. And I have another interesting one is competition. I've spoken at Adobe conferences, and that's very daunting. Talk to people who work in, competing technologies so you can understand what it is that they expect and adjust. Probably the strongest tip is don't expect you're going to deliver the information in the same format for all the various audiences. That also goes for online. There's very different audiences on, for example, Facebook and Twitter versus your blog, and you need to interact with your audiences and understand what they want.
And I guess there's a fair amount of rehearsals as well.
Yeah, the amount of rehearsal depends on, how much time you have, and then the whether the live event's going to be recorded. That always causes me to have more rehearsal. You rehearse with trusted technologists. I like to do a preview of a keynote or a full session that's going to be delivered at a for-pay technical conference, like a tech ed, to a user group. Because user groups will benefit from the information, and user groups are generally much more forgiving because you're doing it for free. And, just be honest with them and say, this is the first time I'm working on this material, and, I think you're going to get something out of it, and I hope that you can share some feedback with me. So there's no substitute for practicing with a live audience. Now, if you don't have that, you can fall back to the practice in front of a mirror or record yourself or something, but, yeah, you really should practice.
You've done a lot of production work, like you've worked in .NET, BizTalk, SharePoint, SQL Server, Analysis Services, MOM, and so on. So what one tip can you provide from each one of your prior production work and each of your certifications?
Well, on the Microsoft platform, I have kind of an interesting background because I came into this, just kind of at the bottom when I did my career change, and I went through all the certifications because, that was the way that I learned. So I came through the networking side first. And then as an elective, I took SQL Server, and I found that I have a real mathematical inclination. And I think anyone that does, it feels really comfortable in the database world, kind of thinks mathematically. So I went through the entire SQL certification, and of all the technology that's to this day my strongest, that's the area I've written two books in, and you know, just very, very interested in all things database and SQL Server. And then to that I added the programming side, because actually it came from a student. A student said to me, you know, you're a really effective SQL instructor, but until you know how SQL is being consumed by an application, you're not really going to be as effective as you could be. So he kind of threw down the gauntlet, and so I said, all right, I think I can do this, and started with ASP and then moved into ASP.NET, and kind of went through the whole the technology stack. So the area where I have the most depth is SQL Server, but I've done production work across the stack, which is a little bit unusual. For example, I've implemented, you know, Active Directory and network security via IPsec, and then, you know, I went on and I did a bunch of SQL Server optimization, and then I moved into customization of Microsoft technologies, a lot of SharePoint before I joined. And sort of the lesson from a Microsoft platform specifically is if you're implementing on Microsoft, make sure you know what we have to offer. I find over and over and over that people who are implementing, no matter what side they're on, if they're IT pros or developers, they will manually implement technologies that could be more easily implemented by just understanding the features of our products. And they just haven't taken the time to really learn the products. And, you know, I don't mean to be judgmental, because people have to get things done, but I particularly see that in things like SharePoint and in SQL Server Business Intelligence, where people are just spending inordinate amounts of time manually coding up solutions that could be much more easily implemented by just looking at the product.
I see. So do your homework.
Yeah.
So what are the best resources for doing your homework?
Well, you know, that's my job now. You know, I'm a technical evangelist, so I'm an educator. So what we're trying to do is be very agile in the way we're providing the information. And kind of a trend we're seeing, particularly in the U.S., is this desire to consume information in a shorter format. So I'll be interested in feedback from people that listen to this recording if we're hitting the target, because we're constantly asking. Sort of the old way, which was, you know, five-day classes or 1 to 2 hour online presentations, is being replaced by micro-learning. So 5 to 15 minute how do I screencast, you know, shorter 15 to 20 minute live presentations. And I can't say that I always like that. Maybe I'm just old-fashioned, but it does seem to be the way that people want to consume content. Another trend is multitasking. So every piece of online content that I've created in the last year, for example, I've created in a way that can be viewed online, but in a way that also can simply be listened to, podcasted. So just as simple as when I am doing demonstrations, instead of saying click here, I'll say click on the file menu, click on the new menu. So if you were, you know, out running or riding your bike and listening to the podcast, you could still get value from it.
Sounds like people will want to go to your blog and also to your MSDN series, Geek Speak.
Yeah, I'm hoping so. My blog is blogs.msdn.com/SoCalDevGal, and I'm really trying to put quite a bit of technical content on the blog. Currently, I'm writing a series on Windows 7 development. I have quite a bit on SQL Server Business Intelligence. I have also created a screencast series that relates to my book. It's a 35-part How Do I BI screencast series. My Geek Speak show on MSDN is a weekly show where we, two developer evangelists, bring on an implementing expert guest who is not a Microsoft employee, who will take questions from the audience and do demos on new technologies. And the idea is to expand the experience of a conference, because, you know, a lot of times people will go to a conference not really to listen to the sessions, but rather to talk to other people who are early adopters. Because as we all know, those folks have a lot of valuable information. So we're trying to replicate that. We've had the series now for almost 3 years. It's a weekly series. It's recorded. And it's one of the top draws on MSDN, so we must be doing something right.
Hey, that's excellent. Well, you know, you do a lot of writing, so what lessons can you share from your writing experiences?
Yeah, well, I've written now two full books, and I've done quite a bit of technical editing. I am by nature more a writer than a speaker, although you wouldn't know it sometimes when you listen to me, because I can talk. But in terms of writing, it all goes back to your English teacher. You know, you must have a good outline. You must have a sort of a hierarchical progression to learning. I think that's very important in technology. And you must write in a clear manner. And you should consider that a lot of your audience will have English as a second language. My audiences for my written content in particular are almost sometimes, depending on the content, can be 60% outside the U.S. And, you know, maybe I'm just assuming here, but when I look at my audience composition as I get my statistics, I am very surprised to see how many non-English speakers I have. So I try to be very cognizant of that when I write, but also when I speak.
Well, that's interesting. So I guess keep the language at a fundamental level as well, right?
Yeah, yeah. Again, when I was in Europe, that was something that's very interesting. I won't say which conference, but at one of the conferences, the conference organizers said that the U.S. speakers tend to get lower scores because, number one, they have too many jokes. They don't provide enough content. And number two, they speak in a fashion that's not understandable. There's too much slang. So it's too difficult for people who have English as a second language to understand them.
So when you write, how many reviews do you do? Like, redrafting again and again, that kind of thing?
Well, it depends on the topic area. You know, I've written two books on SQL Server Business Intelligence, and I've been teaching it and working with it for, you know, I don't know, 10 years. So if it's something that I'm really comfortable with, like implementation of an OLAP cube, I can pretty much just take what's in my brain and write it one time and then go back after it for, the quality of the communication. But from a technical standpoint, I pretty much understand what's there. Now, if I have something new, like the Windows 7 stuff I've been writing, I will review it. I'll make the outline, and then I'll write it, and then I'll review it once for clarity, and then I'll review it again for technical content and technical quality. So two reviews if it's new, one if it's not.
Now, tell us more about the Mona Foundation and then the SmartCare.
The Mona Foundation is a nonprofit that's founded by a former Microsoft employee who now works at a partner. And I had discovered this when I was being a vendor for this woman up in Redmond, and I did the research on her background. I found she had started this foundation. Her name is Manaz Javed, and she is Persian by birth and left Iran after the revolution because of the oppression of women. She's a professional woman and was quite appalled at what was going on in not only her country but in different areas in the world. Mona herself was an actual person. She was a woman that was hanged in Iran for her religious beliefs at 17, and that was really the catalyst for Manaz to start this foundation, which provides support to educational institutions around the world. It's not just in the Middle East. It's actually, they operate in every continent now. But Manaz's vision and dream was that through education, particularly education of women and children, that this type of horrible oppression could be mitigated. And when I met her, she was operating, I think they had five different projects where they're building schools in South America and in the Middle East. And the foundation just had its 10th year anniversary. And they're operating now all over the world, and it's just very, she's my personal inspiration. It's very inspiring to see what she's been able to do. And I dedicated my second book and am donating a portion of the profits of that book to the Mona Foundation. Also from a technology standpoint, I helped them kind of in the early time by designing some databases for their information, because they were a typical startup. You know, they had their donor information on spreadsheets on laptops when I was working with them. This is, gosh, about 8-9 years ago. That's Mona, and I continue to support them by what I call evangelism about the Mona Foundation, because they do fantastic work. And if anyone's interested, it's monafoundation.org. So then you asked about SmartCare. SmartCare is my current sort of focus in terms of nonprofits. I've been involved for about 5 years now, mostly as a remote volunteer. SmartCare is an electronic medical records application that is built on .NET. It uses touchscreens, and it uses smart cards for data storage. And it's the vision of a U.S. doctor, Mark Shields, who is from Atlanta, and it's being implemented in Zambia. It's been accepted as the national standard, and it is now being developed or localized in Ethiopia and starting a pilot in South Africa. So I got involved as a technical trainer on the database side about 4 or 5 years ago and was doing work remotely, and a colleague of mine who's from South Africa and we are now both at Microsoft. We had done some work together professionally, and I have been volunteering, and that's one of the reasons that I made this recent trip to Africa as well.
Well, that's fascinating. I just want to congratulate you or express the audience's appreciation, actually, for all this kind of great work you're doing.
Well, you know, I would really encourage technologists who are listening to discover some opportunities for giving back, because it's been one of the greatest parts of my career as a technologist. When I was just initially learning, I did very small contributions. When I was just learning networking and just learning databases, I worked with churches and schools and museums in Southern California, and I helped them with little small projects. And it was so beneficial because they were so grateful for the help, and it allowed me to learn in a really great way. And as I did this work, I wanted to expand the scope. And this sort of unique opportunity has come up in Southern Africa that really has the potential to make a huge impact throughout the world, actually. And I'm really grateful to be a part of it.
You know, getting back to your blogs and GeekSpeak and all the other things that you do, you must come across some really great ideas, what I would call IT best practices. Can you share some of them?
Oh, I do. And I also see that when I am speaking and customers come and talk to me at conferences about situations, or they share information. I get probably 100 to 200 emails a day, and most of them are from customers, which is great. That's my job. So best practices across the entire stack that I think are important for your audience to consider are, number one, to create baselines. And it's just such an obvious thing, but it's one of those differentiators. When I'm talking to any technologist about really any situation, whether it's network throughput or whether it's application performance, one of the first questions out of my mouth is always, do you have baselines? And that sort of, separates the pros from the amateurs. Yes, we do. And then I have a nice feeling, or what? Then I say, well, we have some opportunity here. Because, if you don't have a baseline, you don't have a way of measuring performance improvement. So baselines is super important. Another thing that I just think is just an area for opportunity is security. And that security baseline as well, so that builds on baselines. But when I was an independent contractor, one of the things I would always do is ask people, would you like me to do a courtesy security audit across your application? And without fail, I found holes in the stack. The database might be completely locked down and just elegantly secured, but then, there would be no security whatsoever as the database information was traversing the network. And just on and on and on. And security is a complex topic, but, we're in a connected world. And people who aren't looking at security across the stack are doing a disservice to whomever they're trying to provide service for. So baselining and security. Another sort of third pillar for me would be technology is about people. And a common thing, the opportunity that I see is that companies will not have enough focus on having enough people, developing the people, allocating resources for training, finding out from the technologists that work at the company what they're really interested in learning. And, those three sort of pillars are things that I look for.
Well, that's interesting. Those are great best practices. Now, let's kind of sort of go into this sort of whole idea of business intelligence. Can you share experiences as a practicing SQL Server BI architect?
Yeah, well, the first thing is, the penetration into the market of business intelligence is not what it can be, because it's new conceptually for most people. I mean, everybody out there knows what a relational database is, and 99% of the businesses have an OLTP or an online transactional, relational data solution in place. But if you go and you ask people, do you have a dedicated reporting solution, or do you have a BI or a data warehouse? There's this complete confusion about what a data warehouse really is. Most people who think they have a data warehouse actually just have some sort of copy of their relational data, and maybe it's denormalized and heavily indexed or something. But this opportunity of having a different type of store, an OLAP store, an online analytical store, or cube, which will deliver super fast and super flexible reports, is something that a lot of people aren't even aware of. And around BI, the first sort of thing is to be aware of what it actually is, why you would care about it, and what it consists of. And BI a Microsoft definition is that you have an OLAP store at the very least. You might also have some data mining models. And then you have clients that connect to such that are usable by the different end user groups. And just getting that baseline is very important. Now, once you have that, then you need to look at, all right, who's going to deliver this? And are we going to, you know, educate the people that are at our company? Are we going to bring in consultants? Because, frankly, most people don't have that domain knowledge because it's not, you know, super hard to acquire. But, you know, people are very busy, especially in this economy, and they don't have time to just pick up new types of knowledge. So another thing is that, you know, you want to bring in people with that domain knowledge so that you can get that done, or invest in educating your own people so that they can build it properly. One of the interesting things about our implementation, sort of typical, is it's almost too easy to use. And that's one of the reasons I wrote the second book in particular. You can open up the tools, the Business Intelligence Development Studio, and you can just click through and create an OLAP cube in 5 minutes using the wizard. But it could be a completely non-performant cube if you don't understand the concepts behind it.
So I guess this goes on to this whole idea on the business side then. So how do you make a business case for implementing business intelligence?
Well, you know, again, it's all about concepts. You know, in my second book, I have 4 sections, and each section has about 8 chapters. And the first section has 7 chapters, and 7 chapters of what you do before you open the tools. Because, like I said, particularly around BI, and we kind of pulled back in 2008. We made the wizards less inclusive, for example. 2005, it was a problem. The product was too easy to use, and people were building, you know, cubes and data stores that just weren't working well at all. So you have to take the time to understand data warehousing concepts, which will include things like what is a star schema, what is a dimensional hierarchy. And it's not, you know, daunting, but you just take some time, whether you watch a webcast or read a book or however it is that you want to learn. You must understand what it is that you're doing when you're clicking through the interface and how, in what format the data should be structured so that you can get a good result.
So maybe you could remind the audience about your 2 books.
Sure. My current book is Smart Business Intelligence Solutions with SQL Server 2008. It's published by MS Press this year. And my previous book is Foundations of SQL Server 2005 Business Intelligence. It was published a couple years ago by A Press. The current book builds on the previous book, so I definitely recommend the current book. Also, I'm working with the Azure teams and the Gemini teams right now, and I may actually be producing, well, at the very least, there'll be some blog content, but I may actually be writing another book on SQL Server as it moves into the cloud or Azure, and we'll be, of course, releasing that later this year. We've announced that. We'll be releasing it at our Professional Developers Conference. So directionally, another area for people who are interested in business intelligence to think about is this new possibility of hosting some or all of your business intelligence in our cloud.
Wow, that's great. I mean, maybe we can do an update podcast just on that topic area.
Yeah. Well, that's my next, after Windows 7 launches, because that's my focus for really through the end of the year, then my next focus is going to be on, you know, sharing technical information about BI in the cloud.
So can you go on to share additional best practices and lessons learned in your many years of really implementing BI solutions in the real world?
Well, one of the areas that people constantly underestimate is data quality. You know, what I have found is that 75% of the work initially is not modeling your cubes and modeling your mining models and figuring out your algorithms and your user interfaces. It's cleaning up your data because, you know, garbage in, garbage out. You have to have high-quality data going into your data warehouse, your business intelligence solution, in order to get high-quality results. So one of the things that I did when I was a practitioner out there is, you know your strengths, and my strength is in the modeling and is in the taxonomy capture and is in the client tools. And I can do the data cleanup, but I'm just not that interested in it. So I actually would hire dedicated SSIS or SQL Server Integration Services professionals to accomplish the data cleanup and the data merge. Because while it's true in fact that you can directly take your data from relational sources, from a practical point, it just never works because that data is invariably has junk in it. The other thing is to be inclusive. You know, most of the time when you go and visit a client the first time, they're going to say, all right, here's my database. You know, the reports don't run in an effective manner. Fix this problem. So they're not thinking, oh, well, there's, you know, 100 spreadsheets on people's desktops, and there's this little Access database here, and then there's this stuff that we get out of a mainframe via a web service that gives us CSV files. very commonly, you know, I would be told, oh, there's one data source, and there would be 10 or 15 or 25. So find all your data sources, identify what they are, do quality checks so you can accurately assess how much it's going to cost to clean this up so that you can give your client an accurate assessment of the time and the resources, and then either, you know, employ an SSIS professional or just allocate resources appropriately so you have clean data. So that's one huge, huge point. A second point is to make the taxonomy natural. And again, that's, I think, because I'm a linguist. So a common problem with source data is that it's obscured. So even something like the column names of the source tables or the data itself is not in a human-readable format. Well, while you're taking the time to clean the data up, capture the actual way people who are going to be using these reports speak. Capture their metrics and write down, almost like a data dictionary, like customer is called a client, so on and so forth. It'd be more complicated, but you get the idea. And then create the business intelligence solution based on the natural taxonomy, which to me just seems an automatic thing, but I find that very, very rarely done, so that the end users can just open it and say, oh, all right, I see, here's my client report and blah, blah, blah. So it's natural. And those are really two very, very important areas that I don't see implemented consistently very well.
Again, great tips. Now, you know, we have already sort of touched on this throughout the interview, but is there anything else you want to add then about your current work and what you hope to achieve?
Well, you know, it's been really exciting how I've been enabled to support women in technology initiatives. So I'm dreaming bigger and bigger. Like I said, DigiGirls is very near and dear to my heart because I'm a mom. I have a daughter, and I see what happens to girls in school around science and technology and math education and how math becomes uncool. So sort of my biggest dream is to somehow make a little dent in this and make it more possible for more young girls to enter careers in technology because, frankly, especially in the world of programming, you know, it is 95% men, and that just is just silly. It's silly from a competitive point because we're not including half of our population. And, you know, the rest of the world isn't necessarily doing this. It's something that's been really interesting to me. In Turkey, in India, in China, half the developers are women. And if we don't kind of, you know, understand this, then it's going to hurt our competitive ability throughout the world. And so I'm hoping that more people want to work on this problem, both men and women. It's not just a problem for women to work on. We have to have inclusion. That's how we're going to be successful.
Do you work with Alice 3 or version 3?
I'm sorry, can you say again?
The development platform from Carnegie Mellon.
Alice, yeah. I've done actually quite a bit of work with Alice. I have spoken with Caitlin Kelleher, who created Alice, and I actually used Alice last year, Storytelling Alice, which was a version that she created just for younger girls, for DigiGirls. But one of the things that I've also done is I've worked with Microsoft Research, and I've pulled some applications that weren't even released to the public. One that now has recently been released, but I worked with a whole year, called Kodu. I don't know if you're familiar with it, but it's a visual programming platform. And it's similar to Alice, but it has more of a game basis. What's interesting is it's not solely a game. And actually, in the work that I did with the MSR team, I did a lot of testing with girls, and they were very interested in making sure that Kodu was not just appealing to boys, and they made actually a lot of changes to the application. And it's recently been released for Xbox. I was working with an academic a pilot version that goes on the PC. So visual programming is something that's very, very interesting to me because I do see that's sort of a paradigm shift that's coming. And it also includes more, gives more inclusion to people who wouldn't look at traditional programming.
You know, it's interesting. I have a keynote going out to a career education society, and it's going to set up practices going out for the next few years, or at least that's the thought or thinking. And there'll be educators from all the schools there, both from K-12 up to post-secondary, and then I guess governments and corporations are there. I'd be interested in getting more data on some of the work that you've been doing, and do you mind if I profile some of this?
No, not at all. Also, I didn't really mention it earlier, but as part of DigiGirls, when I first started working with DigiGirls, it was more of a lecture and listen kind of program, and I really didn't think that was as effective as it could be, so I developed a whole bunch of hands-on courses and for my camps and days, and those courses are actually being used worldwide now. So I'm not the only person to develop DigiGirls courses, but I'm kind of a lead or a core person. So I'm quite interested in applications and methodologies for teaching K-12. Now, that being said, I am not a school teacher. So one of the things I constantly do is I check my coursework, because I have done quite a few presentations at local community events, bar camps, code camps. I even presented in Belgium at the Girl Geek Dinner on this coursework. And I constantly ask, are there any K-12 teachers in the audience? Please tell me if I'm on the right track here. But I think because the amount of time I've been spending with it, and I do run focus groups with girls that age, I'm hitting some good points, because most of the teachers are telling me that they're finding the curriculum useful. So I'd be happy to talk about that.
Do you have a link that people can go to where they can pick up some of these resources?
Yeah, I post everything on my blog. So again, if you just go to my blog and then I hashtag it with helping. I've actually posted all my PowerPoint decks for all the courses. Another course I've had really great success with is this new little program that a gentleman at Microsoft wrote called Small Basic. Some of your listeners might remember the logo turtle, and he basically took that idea to create a real simple programming environment with a turtle and some other things, and it gets people started coding. So Small Basic is one we had really great success with, and I have courseware around that. And then we're starting to do work with Lego Mindstorms and robotics. So because we've got the robotics studio on Microsoft platform. So robots are always fun, right?
So. So when they go to your blog, though, do they have to drill into your blog, or do you have an actual repository on your blog?
They have to just, everything is hashtagged, so just search by helping.
Okay.
You should be able to find it. And if not, you can drop me an email from my blog. So just blogs.msdn.com/SoCalDevGal, and you can send an email from there and just say, I'm looking for the DigiGirls content.
Yeah, that's a great tip for the audience, because this also goes out to a lot of academics out there. So.
Yeah, and I really welcome reuse of the content, any comments on the content. The big vision is to create this virtual DigiGirls where this content is available not just for Microsoft events, but for educators worldwide, because one of the things I'm seeing in the U.S. is, I think this is the last generation, but a lot of the educators didn't grow up with computers. And so it's very challenging for them to try to teach technology to children that have grown up with computers. And I think this will be, this is the only generation that's going to be a real problem, but I see this over and over in schools where the kids know, as much or more than the teachers. So, the biggest vision is to do anything that I can do through DigiGirls to help and share, what we've done.
Well, this is excellent. Now, we talked about great resources in a number of areas. What would you consider then the best job resources for IT professionals?
So I think that the best jobs never get advertised, because the open positions, come up quickly, and they're new projects, and it's not because, someone lost their job or something like that. I mean, that happens, and I think that still the best way to find out what's going on is to talk to people directly. And technology professionals have a great opportunity through user groups. One of the great things about my current job is I do support the user groups. And in Southern California, we're so fortunate. I mean, on the developer side, we have over 30 user groups. And we're starting to see more and more IT pro user groups. Now, in my experience, IT pro user groups aren't as prevalent as developer user groups, and I don't exactly know why. But user groups, to me, are such a great opportunity, because who attends a user group? Somebody who's very ambitious. So those are the kind of people that you're going to want to know, and which companies support user groups, companies that support education. So user groups are a fantastic way. Conferences, secondary, you can't always afford to go to a conference. One thing, kind of a new tip, is more and more conferences are going virtual because of the economy, because people can't travel as much. So attend virtual conferences. Go into chat rooms, because a lot of them have chat rooms. So sort of the focus area is talk to people like you. Talk to professional people. Don't waste time trolling ads and, looking for posted open positions. That to me is not a good use of time. It's get into the network and know people.
Wow, it's all about relationships, it sounds like.
I think so, yeah.
What are your added suggestions for managing the economic challenges that are out there?
One of the things that we've been doing at Microsoft is we've been trying to emphasize what aspects of our software and resources are free. And, know from whatever vendor you work with what's free. For example, SQL Server Express 2008 now includes reporting services. That's fantastic. So you have a front-to-back reporting solution that is free, basically. So know what's free. Another example, this year we've really been expanding our BizSpark program, which is for startups. So if you're thinking of starting a company, you know, there, you have options other than open source. So know what's free and understand if that's going to work for you. That's sort of a first option. Secondly, make really, really great use of all those connections that you're getting through the user groups or through the conferences or whatever, because people are your greatest resource. And you utilize the people that you know in a time-efficient manner for those people. Again, this goes back to my roots as a linguist. You're going to get more answers from technical professionals if you communicate with them in an efficient way and in a way that they want to be communicated with. This is sort of a general business tip, but I think in tough times where you need to get answers, the right answers fast, this can really help people. If you meet a person who is very esteemed, ask them straight out, how would you like to be communicated with? Do you like chat? Do you like email? Do you like phone calls? What do you like? And it's just the simplest thing, but I can get answers from people that supposedly no one can get answers from because I've simply asked them that.
Hey, that's a great tip. You know, there's a lot of change, and I guess for IT professionals and developers, change is a big kind of challenge for them. So how do you manage change, and what lessons can you pass on?
Well, I think, you know, people have different people's nature is different, and I'm fortunate in that I embrace change. I love change. In fact, if you want to be really dramatic about it, I'm almost ADD. I don't like anything that's repetitive. And I think that that is, you know, not everybody's going to be that way. But whether or not you like change, especially in the United States, change is, in technology is what it's about. So actually, if you don't like change, you might want to consider a different career because it moves so quickly here. One of the challenges, though, is that there's so much changing so fast, it's important that you focus and eliminate certain things. And that's really, really difficult. I mean, for example, I've been really focusing on thick client or Windows development, and I've been kind of not paying as much attention to web development, which seems strange to me because for a while I was a web developer. But you just can't know everything, so it's much better to be deep in a couple of technologies rather than a generalist. Across all technologies, because being deep is more highly valued.
You know, you are this renowned developer, a visionary executive, a best-selling author, a top internationally acclaimed solutions architect, and you're known throughout the world. So you know what? You're at the hub of this ecosystem worldwide. So you know, I'm gonna pick your brains here. And can you make the predictions, like your best predictions for the future, the implications, and how IT professionals and executives can prepare?
Well, I'll do my best. I don't know. I don't know if I'm worth that buildup, but the cloud, you have to pay attention to the cloud. Interesting, though, depends on where you are, right? You know, just when, you know, I'm just thinking, oh, yeah, it's the cloud. It's all about the cloud. Well, then I take a trip to sub-Saharan Africa. In some places, sub-Saharan Africa would be one, it is not all about the cloud because, frankly, they do not have the internet connectivity to support the cloud. So you have to always be aware of your surroundings. But if you're in a developed area with high-speed internet connectivity, you must pay attention to the cloud. It's a huge paradigm shift. And whether or not you like it, it's hitting us with full force. You know, we are going to have our offering, but, you know, Google's already out there. Amazon's already out there. It's directionally where we're going. That's number one. Number two, this whole idea of attention. Again, I can't necessarily say that I like it, but living in Southern California, I'm on the cutting edge. And attention spans are shrinking. And that matters in all ways that we deliver content, whether it's can somebody wait 2 minutes for a report to process, or can we deliver a training that takes 15 minutes or 1 hour or 2 hours or so on and so forth. Use of social media is a huge trend that I've seen. When I started at Microsoft 3 years ago, I didn't even blog. I barely used Instant Messenger. I was a solution architect. You know, I would go to a client site. I would look at their data. I would design a solution. I would sit there. I would work with them. There wasn't this need to be constantly connected across social networks. And, yes, some of it is because of the job that I have chosen and taken to be an evangelist, to be a communicator. But social networking cannot be ignored. The area that I see as most prevalent is Facebook. Every place that I've gone in the world, one thing that struck me really particularly in Africa, at TechEd Africa, is one thing that I always look at when I go to a conference at a TechEd is I walk up and down, as I'm walking up and down the hallway, I look and see what people are doing on the machines where they can disconnect. And this is the first time, and it was so interesting, it was in Africa, that people were not connecting to Outlook first thing. They were connecting to Facebook. and it kind of unnerved me. I thought, wow, it's that big, and this was in Africa. Now, one thing I haven't seen yet is Twitter being used a lot outside the U.S. So it's really interesting. I see Facebook everywhere, but I don't see Twitter everywhere. So, you know, you have to pay attention to the relevant social networks, and you just have to. You know, I know a lot of people are very resistant. I'm interested to see what's going to happen to blogs. I'm kind of working through that myself. When I first started at Microsoft, I kind of had a personal aspect to my blog, but I've moved all that to Facebook now, and my blog is almost purely technical. And my blog is tending to get longer and longer and longer, more like a mini book or a magazine in a way. And I'm trying to see if that's right. I'm constantly testing that. So this shifting water of social media is an area to pay attention to as well.
So you got some interesting stories there. I like this aspect about Africa and they're using Facebook.
Yeah, it's unexpected, isn't it?
You know what? I'm going to share that with the audience when I have my keynote coming out. So.
Yeah. You know, it's just I have as many Facebook friends from Africa as I do from Europe. And I don't think people would expect that.
You mentioned Twitter and Twitter being very popular in, let's say, in North America. So if people wanted to follow you on Twitter, do you have a handle?
Yes, I do. I'm LLANGIT, L Langit, and I have protected my updates, but I will approve. Just say, you know, listen to you on the show or whatever. The reason is I find a lot of inappropriate use of Twitter lately. I'm a person who believes that Twitter is more for people than for companies. I've seen a lot of multi-level marketers, a lot of, you know, things even worse than that. So I've chosen to protect my updates. So I don't have a huge amount of Twitter followers, but I personally approve every one of them, and I find that is actually more meaningful. So that's just something that I've done. Some people are the opposite. You know, they'll have thousands of followers, but I'm more emphasizing quality rather than quantity on my social networks, and that's working better for me.
Well, that's interesting. Now, what do you see as the top three challenges facing us today, and how do you propose they be solved?
Yeah. Well, I mean, in U.S. in particular, it's the economy. You know, the economy is in SoCal, it's just been so dramatic to, get the greatest value from the technology that we have. And again, we've tried to adjust to that at Microsoft. One of the things we've done in evangelism is we used to be 75% future-focused and 25% current, and we made the conscious decision on our team to be at least 50-50. So, in other words, to provide free education to around current products. Now, it's not as deep as you get from a training center, but we made that decision, and hopefully other companies have made that decision as well. So from a survival standpoint or being successful, one thing is, again, going back to that, know what is free. Know what companies are offering. Because, you know, people who are working now, I often kind of joke and I say, well, if you're lucky enough to have a job, someone else has been laid off, and so you actually have two jobs. So you either have two jobs or you have no job. So if you have two jobs, you're scrambling just to get the work done. So take advantage of the free stuff, take advantage of the micro content, because you're providing more value to your employer and you're going to have more success. So take advantage of what's there. Constantly pay attention to what's new. You know, if you don't have time in your calendar every week to update your skills, then you're at risk for being outdated. And again, if you don't like that kind of environment, you might want to consider a different career because that's what it is around technology. So, you know, like I said, pay attention to cloud. Pay attention to social networking. Pay attention to the things that are coming new. Pay attention to BI. BI is going to be, I think, within the next 3 to 5 years, it's going to be in 50% of the database implementations. And what is it now, 5 or 10%? So those who are paying attention to BI, they're going to thrive because they're going to provide usable and agile reporting, and that's going to help their companies. So, pay attention to those trends. Pay attention to education. Use your social networks. Have a social network. You know, if you do unfortunately get laid off or something, you know, happens where you don't want to be staying at your job, try to network so that you can get into a better position before you get laid off. Because as we all know, when you don't have a job, it's much more difficult to find one. Be very open in what you might do for a job. I do have some friends that have been struggling through this layoff period, and some of them have gotten new jobs and they've been very flexible. People who are not flexible, I only want to do this, this, and this, and this is my background, and I don't know anything else, they're going to have a lot harder time. You know, so be flexible. Go learn something. Go do some work for a nonprofit if you're not working and you can have a little money to tide you over just to show that you're agile. And, you know, there are opportunities, but you have to work harder for them. You have to work harder for them. So hopefully that gives some tips for people.
I think a good tip is just look at your profile. You're a model for success and being agile and being engaged and involved and all of the things that you mentioned.
Well, you know, I always say that, you know, you can either drive or be driven in your career, right? Like you're in a car, you're either the driver or somebody is driving you. And I would much rather drive. And in order to drive, you have to know something about the car, you have to know something about the road, and you have to know something about where you're going. And those are your obligations. And if you do that, you know, knock on wood, so far, that's worked for me. You know, I'm always looking slightly ahead, always looking without losing focus on current. You know, you don't want to look too much ahead. But if you don't look ahead at all and just, well, things are fine, I'm just going to cruise along, well, maybe not. You know, you have to look ahead a little bit.
You know, these are the profiles and the characteristics of people who are exceptional like yourself. So now we're going to change or shift gears here just for a moment before we end the interview. And, you know, there's this UN-founded IFIP, which is the International Federation for Information Processing. And they're the official UNESCO consultative body in IT. And they have this program called IP3, and that stands for the International Professional Practice Partnership Program, which is launching a professional certification in a global profession this year. And it's all about professionalizing the profession. Do you have any comments on that?
Oh, thank you for telling me. I am a huge proponent of that. One of the other things that I study, that I actually have a certification in, is something called a Microsoft Solutions Framework, which is a, I don't know, are you familiar with MSF?
Yes.
Okay, I don't know if your listeners will be. It's a methodology for implementing software projects, whether they're IT projects or whether they're development projects. And it was really interesting because when I certified on it, it was newly being offered outside Microsoft, and I actually was in the first group that was certified outside of Microsoft, and because it's a methodology Microsoft uses itself to produce software, software lifecycle. And I had to certify orally. Oh, that was my, you know, I have all these IT certifications. I have, you know, the DBA and the MCSE and the developer, and I have all of them. And I've got to say that that was the most difficult because of the need to certify orally in front of the people who had designed the methodology. So I really learned. So the point, as it relates to this certification you talked about, is to, it was the same thing. I mean, what you're talking about is a much broader scale. That's why it's exciting to me. But having a professional methodology and a life cycle methodology is so important. And I was shocked when I came over to the world of software because I had come from the business world that, you know, people would go and ask for, you know, money from their companies or from venture capitalists for these software projects, and they wouldn't have a project plan or methodology because, you know, again, in the business world, I used to make the comparison. If you were going to build a building, physically build a building, and you were going to go to a bank, and you didn't have a written plan, the bank would laugh you out the door. But that actually was happening in software because, you know, this was shortly after the dot-com, you know, startup kind of craziness. And I said, you know, we are such a young industry. We have to have mature and responsible practices to overcome the unacceptably high failure rates of most projects. And, you know, that at that time was around methodology. But I'm super excited to hear that there's a sort of a higher level effort around process improvement because we are a young industry and we do need it. So that's great.
Well, Lynn, do you have any closing comments and anything else that we've missed, perhaps? Or maybe let's reframe this here. I mean, if you were conducting this interview, are there any questions that you would have asked of yourself, and then what would be your answers?
No, not really. I feel like if you've listened this long, thank you for paying attention, and I hope that you got some tips and information that were worthwhile. Also, I really welcome feedback. You know, I'm just one gal out here trying to make my way in the world and do something that's, you know, memorable and good. And, you know, I get better through feedback. So I welcome any feedback, whether you agree or disagree with anything that I've said or that you find something valuable. That's always really great for me to hear. Or, you know, just any comments or tips that you might have because, you know, how we improve is by working together. So I thank everybody for listening. And the best way to give me feedback is through my blog, so blogs.msdn.com/SoCalDevGal. And I do answer. I spend a large amount of time answering all feedback. The best way to get a hold of me is through email because of my speaking engagements. But I really welcome any comments that your listeners would have.
Well, that's excellent. I mean, I like the fact that you're engaged with the audience. So, well, you know, we thank you. I know your schedule is very demanding. It was hard to line this up, so we're indeed fortunate to have you come in to do this interview. And you know, we're really appreciative. And really thank you for sharing your substantial wisdom and insights with our audience.
Great. Well, thank you very much for having me, and it was a pleasure. Thank you.
I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with Lynn Langit, highly regarded and renowned developer, visionary executive, best-selling author, top internationally acclaimed solutions architect, Microsoft Redmond.